All right, Acts 8 is where we need to head off to. We're finishing up Acts chapter 7. I think we'll go ahead and read the final verses in there. This is, of course, some information about Stephen's death. Anybody remember how he died?
Stoning.
He dies by stoning. That is correct. So as you look at Acts 7, let's start with 57. You have the members of the Sanhedrin. The Bible says they cried out with a loud voice. They stopped their ears. They rushed upon him with one accord. And they cast him out of the city and stoned him, and the witnesses laid down their garments at the feet of a young man named Saul. And they stoned Stephen, he called upon the Lord, saying, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. And he kneeled down and cried with a loud voice, Lord, lay not this sin to their charge. And when he had said this, he fell asleep. And Saul was consenting unto his death, and there arose on that day a great persecution against the church which was in Jerusalem, and they were all scattered abroad throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. We want to especially focus on Acts chapter 8 and verse 1. As you look at the church here, and we'll say more about this in a bit, but you have sometimes people, or even rodents, scattering and hide. Teresa and I, the first apartment that we were in, we were very, very poor. And we were trying to save up some money to move because of the military. And the place that we were in, the military, they had at that time, and I suspect that that's still true, they had at that time a list of places that you couldn't rent. Couldn't rent them because they were either a fire hazard or there was something else about the place that made it unfit. And in that particular place, I think I've mentioned this before, but you turn on the light at night and the roaches, they just scatter. And when the roaches scatter, they scatter and hide. They don't want to, you know, hang around so you can knock them off and kill them. But there are some times where things scatter and hide. But is that what the Christians did? You think they scattered and hid? No, they scattered. They have to go to a different area because they're not all wanting to be killed off, but they scatter so they can continue life and also continue what? Presumably teach the gospel of Christ. So as you think about persecution here, one source said persecution does to the church what wind does to seed. It scatters it and only produces a greater harvest. Now, as the Christians are scattering a little bit, I wonder if maybe in the back of their minds they're thinking about the Jews. Anybody remember what had happened to the Jewish people? Had they also scattered? Peter talks about the dispersion. He talks about presumably some Jews who had been dispersed because of the captivity. The Jews, they went into Assyrian captivity. They went into Babylonian captivity. And after that, you know, they end up dispersing through some places where they had not previously been. So maybe Christians were thinking about that, that God's people had been dispersed before. So this is not anything that's going to be too new. God has allowed that to happen before, and he's allowing that to happen again. Additionally, beyond that, we sing some songs sometimes that maybe these Christians didn't sing as far as the exact words, but maybe similar. What's that one song? This world is not my home. I'm just passing through. Do you think these Christians may have been mindful of those words as they're scattered from their homes? I mean, you're having to leave behind your home, your job, maybe some family members, place you like to eat, whatever it might be, and set up shop somewhere else. That's a good reminder that this world is not going to be a place where we're going to spend forever. I was thinking about that a little bit this morning. I mentioned these people before, some new neighbors. They're not quite through with their house yet. But they've said that this is our dream home. And we hear people talking about that sometimes. We have our dream home. Or now I have my dream job. Or this is my dream car. Or this is my dream whatever. And there's nothing wrong with having a hope, a goal, an aspiration, a desire, and achieving that. That's great. But at the same time, when you do hear people use that wording, you kind of start thinking, what about them? Your hopes are really rooted where? Here. The dream home should be what? Heaven. So we might have a house that we really like. We might have a car that we really appreciate. It might be some jewelry that is especially, you know, we were hoping for years to get a certain ring or whatever it might be. And we finally achieve that. But remember, this world is not our true and permanent home. As you look at Acts 8:1, the first part of the verse, you have some keywords. The word which is translated persecution, it always describes religious persecution. You think people can be persecuted for different reasons? Some non-religious reasons would be what? All right, that's a good one. People are persecuted because of their race. You're not of our race or you're not of our social class, those kinds of things. So because people are different in that way. What else? People are persecuted because... All right, social standing, not exactly the same as race, but sort of in the same category. People are persecuted because of?
Education.
All right, they're persecuted because of education. You have more, you have less. What about persecuted because of the way they talk?
Their
Not so much, I think, as far as our area of the country, but you move to some other areas of the country and the accent is very thick, or people may speak a little more slowly, and people are made fun of for that. Ray, you had a thought?
Yeah. One of the others mentioned, because of work and things like that, I can think of a janitor's type job.
Okay.
A lot of times we don't think that being very good, but if we really look at it, it's very necessary to have. So it's a good thing, but we might still think of them.
Sure. People are mocked sometimes for the work that they do. This guy is sweeping floors. This guy's on the 32nd floor in an office building. And the guy who is sweeping the floor thinks that this guy doesn't know anything. This guy thinks, well, that guy doesn't have any skills whatsoever. So you do find that, and it may not be persecution in that sense, but ridicule, mocking, some things that would certainly be in that category, in that vein of thought. Anything else? Dolores? All right, that would be another great answer, that people would look at that and they would poke, especially in the earlier years. Kids in school, they'll poke fun at other kids. So persecution can take a lot of forms, but in Acts chapter 8, we're talking specifically about religious persecution. The word's limited to here, verse 4, plus in over Acts chapter 11 and verse 19. You also have this word which is translated scattered. That's also an important word. It comes from spiro, and that word describes sowing seed. I was thinking about that last night. We had a tree taken out, and now it's a good time of year to plant grass seed. So I went out and got some more dirt, put some more dirt where they had created the hole because the tree was taken out, and then planted some grass seed. And I was really careful. Teresa's not in the class, and if she were, she would probably tell you, raise her hand and tell you that I've been bad over the years. I don't think so, but she thinks I've been bad over the years about getting some grass seed in her flower beds. If you're out there and you're sowing that grass seed and there's some wind, that will oftentimes carry that over to an area where you don't want it carried to. And I don't mind that so much because I like thick grass. But if that's your flower bed and that's close by and the wind is blowing and that ends up in the flower bed and ends up growing, well, that's probably not where you want that to be. But this word, which...
control that wind?
Yeah. I wish. But in this particular case, you have a word which is describing the sowing of seed. So you can think of that as far as these Christians, they're being scattered here, there, and everywhere. One source said, and I like the quote, this is an excellent image because the church must germinate or terminate. Now think about that. That's a good quote. You either germinate, you grow, or you're going to terminate. He furthered the quote a little bit. He said it's either going to evangelize or it's going to fossilize. And that's true as well. So we always want to be doing our best to head out and do what God has to say. All right, now here's some things that are a little challenging. Luke said how many Christians apparently left the city? All. All right, now he makes that point. Do you understand that literally, or do you say, I don't think that's literal? All right, I think that is one good possibility, that sometimes we say, everybody was there. Well, that's not true. Or we say, everybody's sick. Well, again, that's not true either, but we have a high percentage of people who were there. We have a number of people who were sick. And it very well could be the case that he doesn't mean every single person, every single Christian left the city of Jerusalem. It could be an exaggeration for emphasis. Or it could be that he's pointing to perhaps what we might refer to as high-profile members of the church. When you start looking at Stephen, the other men who were serving with him, helping out the widows, they probably had a little higher profile than some others, and it may be that that's what he means. Now, why would you say that those two conclusions are especially necessary? Well, what if we read down a couple more verses, verse 3 specifically? What do we find there? Saul, he's doing what? Lays waste to the church. He's entering where? Every house, and he's dragging out men and women. Now, do you think those men and women are just males and females, or males and females who are Christians? Males and females, or males and females who are Christians? Which do you think is right? They're Christians. All right, now, if everybody leaves, Acts chapter 8 and verse 1, who's left to pull out? Acts 8 and verse 3. There shouldn't be anybody left. So when you look at Acts 8, 1, everybody leaves, and you look at Acts chapter 8 and verse 3, there's still some people left. You have to say, okay, that all doesn't mean all. Either, as Carol said, this is a hyperbole, it's an exaggeration for emphasis, a lot of people left, or it's a way of saying perhaps that a lot of the high-profile people left, but there were still some Christians there. There are some other people who suggest that this means all the Greek-speaking Jews, people who had the same kind of background as Stephen. Again, that's a possibility. I'm not so persuaded as the other possibilities that that is probably the best one. A couple of the things, and then we'll see if there's anything you want to add or ask. It's been asked why the apostles decided to stay around Jerusalem. Everybody's headed out, but the apostles stay there. Why do you think they might have hung around? All right, I think that's a possibility. It's possible that there were still some people. Jerusalem had been a very fertile field. And just as you would go back and maybe continue to work, if you're out there in the grape area, grape arbor, or you're out there picking raspberries or blueberries, whatever it might be, you think, I've gotten a lot from the patch, but there's still more to get. So it may be that they thought that we need to stay here, and God's going to protect us, and that's going to work out the best way. So the reason is not given, but that certainly is one possibility. It's also possible that this is true. If the Sanhedrin had failed to successfully persecute and prosecute the apostles, and now they're focused on what we might refer to as quote-unquote lesser, and I don't mean that in any bad sense, I simply mean they're not as high profile. Now they're focused on some members who are not as visible as the apostles. What might that have allowed the apostles to do? Yeah, we're going to move around a little bit. We're not going to be in the eyes of the authorities quite as visible. So we're going to be able to continue our work while the Sanhedrin and people like Paul go after some others. The apostles might have also been benefiting from this kind of thinking. If you get rid of all the members of the congregation, how's that going to work out for the preacher? Probably not pretty well. So maybe they're thinking, if we can drive these people out of town, get rid of these folks, then what's that going to do to the apostles? That's going to shut them down. So if we can't get them this way, we're going to go after them this way. And you could have a couple of things here that, as far as multiple possibilities, that's what we have. But Jerusalem was a city of activity, a lot of people coming, a lot of people going. And it's kind of interesting to me that when you go back and you think about Gamaliel's advice, that's back in Acts chapter 5 and verse 38. You remember what he advised? Leave them alone. Now, the Sanhedrin was not immediately willing to do that, but maybe after a little time passes, they start seeing the wisdom of that advice, and they back off the apostles a little bit. But at this point in time, these are the developments. Carol, did you have a thought? Okay. Anybody else want to contribute something? Ray?
At this time, is this about AD 70?
No.
Is this before that?
Yeah, I think you're maybe looking probably no more than 5 years into the establishment of the church, maybe closer to 2 or 3.
Okay.
So, anybody else? Don?
Well, Luke has been writing here not necessarily chronologically, but in the events. Because it sort of indicates that Saul was the leader of the persecution.
At this point, he seems to take the forefront. He jumps. There have been some who have suggested, and I think this is at least a possibility when you go back and you consider his academic credentials, that he was a member of the Sanhedrin. Now, if that's true, he would have definitely been on the youngest side of the Sanhedrin membership, if you will. Today, when you think about Supreme Court members, age-wise, what do you think?
Old.
Yeah, I mean, if a guy gets on it at 50, you're thinking he seems pretty young. You know, I think normally you're thinking 60 or maybe in the 70s and so forth. What happens if you have a Supreme Court member who's on there at 35 or 40? I mean, you'd have to kind of look back and say, wow, there's got to be something about that guy that really stands out. I mean, he got started early, and he is just especially brilliant. He knows the law very well. That happens sometimes, not often. And when you look at Saul's pedigree and so forth, remember the point that we made recently in a class I asked, I think that was last Sunday, how well would have Saul fit in with the apostles? Not very well, because he's just coming from a completely different perspective and background. So initially, he wouldn't have fit in very well. But later, after everything kind of unfolds, then he's able to integrate into the group pretty well.
The reason I say that is, you know, he was spearheading the persecution, and they would be leaving because of the head of it, not to be persecuted and scattered out. And then later on, he requests to go to Damascus.
Yeah.
As if he weeded out everybody he knew in Jerusalem. So it could have been possible that only the apostles were left at a certain time. This doesn't mean they were left immediately, but after a certain time, there was only
apostles there. Yeah. Yeah. Again, we've got limited information as far as what was taking place, so you have to put a number of options on the table there as far as trying to unfold what occurred. Okay, let's take a look down And what we find a little bit later, Acts chapter 8, verses 2 and 3. And devout men buried Stephen and made great lamentation over him. But Saul laid the church waste, entering into every house and dragging men and women, committing them to prison. All right, now you have some devout people. Do we know who they are? No. Yep. No. Here you have devout people. That could describe a lot of people. Could it describe a Christian? Yes. You would hope so. Could it also describe a non-Christian? Yes. And when you think about some of the Jews, they certainly were devout people. You find that back in Acts chapter 2. So you could have had here some Jews who were sympathetic to Christians. And they thought, okay, the Sanhedrin has been involved with this guy's death. We're not really supportive of that. So we're going to lend him a little bit of help. And that could have been dangerous for them, but it's possible. When you think about that in relation to John chapter 19, verses 38 and 39, you have Joseph and you have Nicodemus. Are they willing to help with Jesus' body? Oh, yeah. Are they apostles? Oh, no. So they're kind of headed towards discipleship, but they're really not quite there yet by the time in John chapter 19. So that could be a very interesting parallel, that here you have two Jews who are perhaps putting a lot at risk trying to help, in that case, the Lord, in this case, help Stephen deal with the body, but they have not yet been obedient to God. Can you see a lesson in that? I think there's a great lesson in that. Here are some devout people. Here are some people with good hearts. They're not quite with the program yet, but they're still sort of helping some. What's the lesson there? Well, I think that's a good lesson, Kitty. That wasn't the one that I was thinking of, but they're almost persuaded. So let's continue to work with them some.
They might be easily taught.
Well, okay, I think that's another great lesson. That's still not quite where I wanted to go. What about today? We've got a work day. Now, you might expect that the people who come are all going to be Christians, or they're going to have non-Christian kids who are from Christian families. Could you have a work day, though, where you have some people who are not Christians that are in the almost persuaded category? Sure. Anything wrong with that? No. We've had that situation here. We've had over the years different events where people have come, people have helped, and they were not a Christian. And sometimes a person says, well, they're going to help. They're not a Christian. Well, okay. Do you have to be a Christian to hold a hammer? No. Need to be a Christian to hold a wash rag? No. Need to be a Christian to sweep the floor? No. So if you're going to come and help, guess what? We're probably going to take the help. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with exposing people to contact with Christians. So that's one of the things that maybe we can take away from the word that is translated devout. When you look at that word devout, it's an adjective. It occurs only here. It's back, as we said, in Acts chapter 2 and verse 5. It's also found in Acts 22 and verse 12. And then it's over in Luke chapter 2 and verse 25 as well. One source described it this way: religious reverence, godliness, or piety. So, once again, it describes people who are good hearts, people who are at least headed towards the spiritual direction of life. Now, one source, as it looked at this word, also gave this additional definition, which I think it says it can also have the sense of nervous caution. It can also have the sense of nervous caution. Can you see how that might be related to what we have in Acts chapter 8? If these guys are not Christians, maybe they're Jews, they want to help, and they do help, but there is nervous caution on their part. Why? Yeah, I mean, you're not with a bunch, but you have gone and you have offered help. Almost, in this case, we might say help to the enemy. But by using that word, Luke does seem to indicate that these men, they were good men, that Stephen was innocent, the Sanhedrin was guilty of wrongdoing. Sometimes you'll find that good men will come to the aid of a person who's been wrong, come to the aid of the unfortunate, and you don't find evil men typically receiving that treatment. So when you have these devout men coming along and assisting, it does indicate that Stephen was someone who was in the right. Anything that you want to add or ask before we mention a couple other points? Ray?
Jesus talked about the Samaritan that stopped by and helped the guy, and the priest and the Levite would not do that.
Yeah.
Same type of thing.
Yeah. So we would again think that here's a good man in many respects. He is a devout man as far as he probably has some piousness, some religious inclinations, and Jesus commended him. So still has a ways to go, but still he's definitely on the right road. Anybody else? Okay. Let's go back and make a couple of the points. Depending on your translation, you may have something like the word buried that I read from in the King James translation. If you have that, it's going to use the word carried. This is also one of those words which is not found or used anywhere else in the New Testament. Thayer defined it as to carry with others, help in carrying out the dead to be burned or to be buried. As you look at that word outside the New Testament, it describes carrying crops to granaries. And here it suggested that people collected all the supplies, the bandages, the spices, whatever was needed to bury a body. Now, if that's what's involved here, and I think that's probably right, then I think the ASV translation, buried, is probably going to be a lot more comprehensive than carry. When you think about carrying something, you might carry something from A to B as far as the places, but you don't do anything other than carry it. But that word which is translated buried, if you use that rendering, that indicates, that implies that everything necessary to bury Stephen was done. One source, this is an old commentator, it was Clark. I want to give you this quote. It's not too lengthy, it's about 4 or 5 sentences. He says, among the Jews, and indeed among most nations of the earth, it was esteemed a work of piety, charity, and mercy to bury the dead. Well, I think that's kind of where people are, even if they're not real religious. Here's someone who's died, whether it's a war zone or not. This is a good thing to bury the dead. He went on to say the Jews did not bury those who were condemned by the Sanhedrin in the burying place of the fathers. Now, do we have any practice which is like that today? Think about that. The Jews, as far as if you were condemned by the Sanhedrin, were not going to bury you in the typical place where we bury the fathers. Need a different cemetery.
Yeah, that happens all the time.
It does. What would some illustrations of that be?
Well, if you're not in such and such a family or such and such a religious group, you're not eligible to be in this cemetery. You have to go wherever else.
Okay. Sometimes it's a religious cemetery. You see some in this area, small cemeteries related to religious groups. I suspect that if you went and asked, could we be buried in your cemetery? The first question would probably be what? Are you a member of this religious group? And if you say no, then the chance is probably going to be no.
I don't know if it's this applies in the same sense, but you have to be eligible to be, go to Arlington. Not mm-hmm. everybody can be,
right.
you know, can go there. It has to, you have to pass certain standards to be.
Yeah, there are some places for veterans. And there are some people, I've seen this, I've not seen this personally, but in places like Arlington, I guess they really try to clamp down on this. You have some people who have someone who's been cremated, and they try to sneak into one of those places and sprinkle the ashes out among the graves. And you would think that would be hard to stop, but they actually have, I guess, some police out there. They have somebody out there, some guards trying to monitor that to make sure that that doesn't happen. But it's not just burying. In that case, it's actually trying to distribute the ashes. So they're really serious about that stuff. That's not new. You see that same kind of thing with the ancient Jews. All right, he went on to say, because they would bury the guilty with the innocent, they had a separate place for those who were stoned and those who were burnt. Now think about that as well. We've got a separate cemetery for your Jew for the people who are stoned, the people who are burnt. Once again, don't we have something similar in our day and time? We don't want to bury some people. You find a mass murderer, and there were a couple of people. You find it not only with the cemetery, but even sometimes with the funeral home. Wasn't it with the snipers, the D.C. snipers, when, maybe they're both still alive. I'm trying to remember the court case where the person finally died or the person was killed, and the whole thing was just so foul-smelling that no funeral home wanted to take the body. I can't remember the exact set of circumstances, but that wasn't that long ago. And then it was kind of like, well, where are they going to be buried? We don't want to be, have them buried in here with our loved ones and our relatives. So it's an old, old problem. He cites a tract which says, the stone wherewith anyone was stoned, the post on which he was hanged, the sword by which he was beheaded, and the cord by which he was strangled were buried in the same place with the bodies of the executed persons. And these persons died under the curse of the law. The instruments by which they were put to death were considered as unclean and accursed, and therewith buried with their bodies. Now, we sort of see the reverse of that. Dave Padgett, if I remember correctly, he wanted to be buried with a fork or with some silverware. Anybody remember that as far as his funeral? He loved potlucks. Okay, so Lois does, and maybe a couple others do. But, you know, that was just kind of his thing. I love potlucks. So, you know, he was buried with some silverware. And you find that there was, well, you'll find that there are some other people who are buried with something. You know, you find that a person that was their favorite brush or favorite piece of jewelry, and I remember a funeral director one time telling me that a wife was buried with a favorite ring, and the kids at a later time all got into a hot dispute over the ring. So they actually had to dig up the body and take the ring off the finger. And, you know, then they had to rebury the body. But people are buried with various things. But normally we associate that in a positive way. This is something that a person loved. But with the Jews, the custom was slightly different. With the instrument of death, as he said, the cord, or with the sword that was used, or with the stone that was used, let's go ahead and put that in there. Just one more way to sort of show how infamous the person was, how evil, how vile the person was. So for the Jews, they had some interesting customs like that. Anything that you want to add or ask over that information? Okay. Going down a little bit more, let's go back and talk about the great lamentation, that is the deep mourning that was following Stephen's death. This is also an important point. When you look at the first century Christians, did they sorrow over death? Yes. Yeah. And we might look back and think, well, yeah, Jesus came and there were the apostles and they were preaching and they were talking about heaven and all those kinds of things. And death didn't really hurt for those guys. It didn't really sting. That's not what you see in Acts chapter 7. Death still stung. And this guy was not a family member in the sense of a blood relative. He was a member of the church. Steve?
Well, one of the cross references I have in my Bible talks about when Abraham came to weep for Sarah. Look how far back
yeah.
it goes from this period right here. So that it's saying it was like, you know, similar to that.
Yeah. Even God's best servants have found the sting of death. That's what Paul compared death to in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 56. Then you may remember, too, another reference by Paul in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 13. Remember what he said? He said, sorrow not as those who have no hope. Now, Paul could have said, don't sorrow. Death is no big deal. You'll get over it quickly. But he didn't say that. He said, sorrow not as much. Sorrow differently. Remember that you as a Christian still have hope when it comes to the loss of loved ones. And if you don't have someone who has died in Christ, then the sorrow is going to be that much more. So when we look at Stephen, his death, it tells us that it's right to mourn the death of a Christian. And in this case, it's a little surprising because, as one source said, it was a dangerous violation of Jewish custom to publicly mourn the death of someone executed for blasphemy. So these guys were not only sorrowing, but to express that sorrow, it would be once again, like today, going out to somebody who's been a serial killer, and you go out to sorrow the death. You're probably going to have some people give you a hard time about that. You're going to be knocked around a little bit for doing that. And certainly for the Jews, that would have been true in this case. I want to give you some additional information about sorrow, but once again, I'm going to stop and see if there's anything that you want to interject. Okay, when you look at sorrow in the Bible, or mourning, it's described in a lot of different ways. One of the familiar ways I think that we're probably familiar with, because you've seen it many times, would be the tearing of clothes. Now, we generally don't do that, but one example of that would be back in 2 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 4. I mean, people just rip their clothes. You may know about the professional mourners. There would be people who would go out to funerals. They'd be paid, and they would stitch up their clothing. It feels like some clothing that you can kind of buy at some stores now. You know, just move it a little bit and rip. There goes the seam. But these people, they stitched their clothes in such a way where they could rip that, and then it could be easily repaired, and they'd put on a show, and that was designed to help people mourn. You find, this would be back in the book of Esther, chapter 4 and verse 3, loud crying. There'd be fasting. People would be dressed in sackcloth. We find those things today. Sometimes people will be crying, sometimes loudly. People will say, I don't want to eat. They may not necessarily be fasting. They may not call it that. Or maybe they're dressed in sackcloth. You see people are dressed in black. It doesn't have to be sackcloth in the sense that it's going to be that hard clothing. One thing that we probably don't see too often is people throwing dust on their heads. Now, in the Bible, you do find that that was a custom, throwing dust on the heads. Joshua chapter 7 and verse 6 would be one example of that. I'm not sure exactly the reason for that, but that was a practice. Sometimes people covered their heads. An example of that would be back in Jeremiah 14, verses 3 and 4. Jeremiah 14, 3 and 4. Again, we see that sometimes today. And then there's this unusual reference, not removing the footwear. Ezekiel chapter 24 and verse 17 would be one reference to that. Now, aside from the Bible, and there may be some other cultures and customs that do that, but I've never seen anyone who is mourning the person's death who says, I'm not going to remove my shoes. But as you look at the Bible, that is one of the things that was done, and you can see that from a cross-reference, 2 Samuel chapter 15 and verse 30. If you were to look at that, you would be able to compare that with the information in what did I give you? Yeah, Ezekiel chapter 24 and verse 17. And find that not removing the footwear was a way to symbolize grief. So people have different techniques, different things that they use to symbolize grief. So because one person does it this way, another person does it that way. Over the years, I've had some people ask me, they say, when it comes to a death, you know, I want to do this, or I don't want to do that. I want to do this because it seems a little unusual, I'm asking, or I don't want to do this, and that seems to be what people do. Is it okay? If a person ever asks you those kinds of questions, is it okay if I do this or don't do this? What do you think the right answer is? Whatever works for you. Yes. If you don't want to do that, that's fine. If you do want to do that, that's fine. I've had some people say, well, I wanted to take a trip shortly after somebody died, and I think that sounds weird. Well, that may not be what everybody does. But if that's what works best for you to help you work through that grief, then that's fine. Another person says, I want to hole up. I don't want to see anybody for a little while. That's fine. If you're going to make that 6 months, that's going to be a problem. But if you just want to get away for a little while and shut everybody out, that's okay. You find some other customs as well. Not letting the hair down, Leviticus chapter 10 and verse 6. Not shaving the head, Jeremiah chapter 16 and verse 6. And not clipping beards, Isaiah chapter 15 and verse 2. So when you begin to look at grief and mourning in the Bible, you find that it spans a lot of different activities, a lot of different customs. Some of those are easily explained and recognized by us, some not. Once again, anything you want to discuss? Okay. As people, as we think about the Christians and they mourn, what's Saul doing? Acts chapter 8 and verse 3. All right, he's persecuting the church. The Bible says that, as far as the ASV, he's laying waste to the church. The King James rendering says he made havoc. That comes, once again, from a single term. It's not found anywhere else in the New Testament, but it is used sometimes, in fact, several times back in the Old Testament. Let's go back to the Old Testament. Take a look at Psalm 80, Psalm 80, verse 13, because you have here that same word being used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, and it is a very vivid word. Psalm 80, verse 13. Who either has it or is about ready to get there, and we'll read it. Carol?
A boar from the forest eats it away, and whatever moves in the field feeds on it.
All right, so you have this boar. He's out there, and you can imagine the boar doing what in the forest? Out there looking for food. All right, he's rooting around. And that's really the image that Luke is trying to get with Paul. It's a word that was described, that described the mangling done by wild beasts such as lions, wolves, bears, boars, and leopards. And Luke not only uses this word, the tense is also significant. Want to make a guess in the tense? It is, it's ongoing. It's going to be the imperfect tense. So this is something that he's doing day after day after day. One source said Paul's zeal against Christians was like a wild boar rooting up the vines in a vineyard. So it's persecution which is fierce, it's persecution which is savage, and it's persecution that is directed not against people who have disabilities, not against people who speak differently than him, not against people who have a different education, but it's directed against people who are Christians. Another source said we have a description of the wolf and his prey. Now think about that. We have a description of the wolf and his prey. Paul, of course, is the wolf. Christians are the prey. Now, isn't it interesting that at a later time, this would be from the book of Acts, Acts chapter 20 and verse 28, Paul talks to the same people, that would be Christians, a different group, but still Christians. And he says to those elders at Ephesus, you are to feed what? The flock of God. So he changes from the wolf to now he is the shepherd. He wants to go from wolf to protector. And when you think about that, what conclusion has to be drawn? I mean, you see this guy who makes this beyond drastic, beyond radical change. I mean, you can't make a change that's any more stark, any more distinct, any more different than that. What do you have to say about this guy? One or two things is true. He's either a nut job or what? He saw the light, or Christ. He had that interaction with Jesus Christ. So when we think about defending the Bible, talking about whether or not Christianity is true and so forth, Saul is one of the great tools that we have to show that Christianity is indeed from God. He turned out to become a leader, preacher, teacher, an apostle, and a founder of many congregations. All right, as you look at Acts chapter 8 and verse 3, you have something else that's helpful here. But Saul laid waste to the church building, right? No. What's it say? He laid waste to the church. Well, he's not going in and torching church buildings, is he? When it says he laid waste to the church, he laid waste to the people, the Christians. So this is one of the verses that allows us to help people understand that the church is not the building. He drags people out. That word which is translated drag is a present tense verb. And was he choosy about the sex? He wasn't saying, well, you're a woman, I'm not going to touch you. What was he doing? Man, woman, young, old, if you're a Christian, he was going to take you off to jail. Now, King James translation has an unusual word. It's probably going to be the word hailing, I believe. That's from an old English form of hauling or violent pulling. That word is used some other times in the New Testament. For example, in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 4, John talks about the devil pulling down a third of the stars. Well, that's a symbolic reference, but again, you can see just what is involved there. Now, the Sanhedrin, as you think about it, did they have the ability to enforce capital punishment? Sanhedrin, capital punishment. No. And we know that because of Jesus, John chapter 18, verse 31. But they could imprison. And that seems to be the authority that Paul is pulling from here. He's using all the influence, all the power that he has to ensure that a number of saints are incarcerated. Let's also talk about this going house to house. You might not think about that initially, but if you stop and pause for a little bit, what do you think is being indicated there? He's going house to house. The police sometimes today search house to house, don't they? There's a shooting in an apartment complex, and they don't know where it is. So it's got 100 units, so they go unit to unit, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way up to 100. But do you think that's the kind of house to house here, or is something else involved? Whose houses?
Christians.
I think just the Christians' houses, not everybody necessarily in Jerusalem. And what else do you think you could put or associate with that? He's searching house to house. Think he's going 7 days a week? Well, maybe. If you want to get Christians, what's probably the best day to go?
On Sunday.
I think on Sunday. It's just kind of like deer hunting. You know, you just don't show up at any old time if you want to hunt deer. You go out when the deer are going to be out. So if you're going to hunt Christians, you're going to hunt them house to house. You're probably looking for the meeting places on the assemblies. And then when you have that prime spot, then you go in, grab them, and you take the group. Carol? Today, what do we have? The police need to find somebody. They're looking for a drug operation. What do they get? Who do they get?
A
confidential informant. They're willing to pay. Do you think the Jews had figured that out? We know that there was bribery of people when it came to Jesus' resurrection. Oh, just say that, you know, you guys were asleep and so forth. So the Jews were not fools. And that may have been one of the things that people used. You know, we've seen that today. People infiltrate a group, don't they? You infiltrate the group, you get information, and then you either sell that or use that in some way. Maybe that is your job. A couple of things here with the last 5 minutes that we have. Paul does get a taste at a later time of what he was doing to Christians. As one source said, the persecutor was to learn himself in later years what it meant to be forcibly dragged about by others and thrown into prison again and again. And then when that happens to Paul, what does he not do? He gets a taste of his own medicine later. What does he not do? Well, that's true. What happens when people usually face problems?
Boy,
what do they do? They whine and complain. Do we get an indication that Paul whined and complained? No. He knew what it was like. He'd been on that side of the fence, and now when it's his turn, this is part of the cost. This is going to be one of the things that I'm going to suffer as a servant of Christ. Let's talk about church buildings for just a bit. Think the first century Christians had a building like ours? No. Where do you think they were meeting? Acts chapter 8.
House to house.
So if they're going house to house, what do you think those houses were being used for throughout the week? All right. That was a living space. And there have been some records. You have to go back to about 300 AD, which would be, you know, about 250 years, 270 years after this time, you do find that they had taken some houses and they had renovated those houses. They were able to open up the space just like we do today. People will say, we're going to take this house and we're going to renovate it. We're either going to, you know, modernize it, or maybe we're going to take this space and we're going to open it up, knock out the walls, and now it's going to be used for something else. But in this case, that was what they were going to use it for, a meeting place and also a place to live. when you start looking in the New Testament, you find, for example, early in the book of Philemon, it's about Philemon 1 and verse 2, Romans 16 verse 5, the church that is in thy house. Well, that's a helpful verse, because if church means church building, it would mean the church building which is in your house. It doesn't mean that. It means the people who are in your house. So when we start thinking about what was taking place in Jerusalem, I believe the first building that I've ever come across was about 100 AD. So you have Christianity in existence for 60 or 70 years before they start thinking about their faith in terms of building. Doesn't that make sense in light of what happened? If Christians are going to be mobile, if they're going to be persecuted, the last thing that they need to do is trying to be hanging on to a building somewhere. They got their faith out of the building, and then they, eventually things became a little more stable, a lot of Christians, and then they began to find some facilities. So nothing wrong with the building. But when you start looking at the book of Acts, you have to always realize that a building is what? It's a building. You know, what you do at the building, you can do at the house. What you can do at the house is going to be what you can do at the building. So you do find some people that have some hang-ups when it comes to buildings or sometimes even their own houses. But the building is nothing more than a building. It's not a holy place. And yet getting that through the minds of people is sometimes a very, very difficult thing to do. Anything that you want to add or ask? Betty?
I think you find even today in the mission field in some of the third world countries that they start church groups, start meeting in homes.
Yeah.
Before they become big enough that they can afford to build a small building or something. So I think that's still done today.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Unless you have somebody coming in with a lot of resources.
Yeah.
Generally, that's...
And even sometimes in the United States, I think they do that occasionally.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like they move to some type of building quicker than what they do in some of the third world countries, but it's still done today.
A lot of congregations have started out with tents. And then, you know, from a tent to maybe a rented structure, and then they end up with some kind of permanent structure. But you do have, and this is a problem with some foreign missionary work, you have a small group of people, and instantly they think, what do we need? We've got to have a building if we're going to survive. Well, that's not necessarily true. Now, there are some cases where unless you are a quote-unquote recognized religious group in a country, you're going to have some issues. You've got to register with that country and some things like that. And having a definite piece of property can be part of that process. But that's a little distinct from what people mean when they say, oh, we have to have a building, we're not going to survive. Well, Fort Wayne, the congregation there, at least one of the congregations there started in homes, and that's happened for a lot of people. Different reasons for that. Sometimes it's size, sometimes it's finances, but that's what you find in the Bible. But like I say, a lot of people, they get really hung up on a building for some reason, and yet that doesn't come along until almost you have the entire New Testament completed. So when people try to go back to the New Testament and say, well, we've got some rules about a building. No. The Bible was completed before the first building ever came along. So you can't go back to Scripture and say, well, we have to do this or can't do that in the building. It's just not there. That it?